Welcome back to Chapters at a Time. Me and Sam are here to discuss the fourth section of Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel,
That's
titled
right.
What's Bad, Chickens. Bad Chickens. All right. So, Sam, what'd you think about Bad Chickens?
I think a lot was revealed to us in this episode, or not, well, obviously this episode, but this chapter and section of the book. We get a lot more backstory about who this Gatsbury guy is.
Gatsbury? I think it's, is it Gaspary or?
Gaspary.
Gasperi?
The first one. Gaspary.
Gaspary.
We get a lot more background on him, and I think we also start to see a lot more of the individual sections of the book so far start to get tied into the overall like narrative of the novel. So that was kind of nice, just because you can see more of the direction it's taking. We learn more about like what these anomalies have been. We learn more about the individual characters that we've experienced so far. We learn the fate of some of them as well.
Yeah, we get a lot to speculate on.
Absolutely. I mean, this was the biggest section within the book, and I really, really liked it. And I liked the time that was spent developing this character and the surrounding aspects of his life. Although I will say that within the section, I think it became very evident by a few of the things that were discussed that it was written around COVID time.
And right. Yeah. We've seen a few of those,
especially with a lot of like, I feel like buzzwords in the scientific sense of like quantum blockchain.
Oh God, the quantum blockchain.
And also like the idea of like, oh, simulation theory. And then it was also talking about like people's ability to focus. And I feel like these were topics that were and still are.
It's pretty Rick relevant, but it's like Rick and Morty language, dude.
Exactly. And I feel like that really came to a peak during like the middle of COVID, which is where I believe she started writing this novel.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I think you touched on a lot of... Have you seen... what's the movie? It's an early Jake Gyllenhaal movie.
Oh.
Around Halloween.
Donnie Darko?
Seen Donnie Darko?
Absolutely.
You know that whole scene whenever there's the teacher and she's like, cellar door is the most beautiful phrase in the English language. I immediately thought about that when I was reading this chapter because I was like, oh my God, quantum blockchain has to be the ugliest phrase in the English language. Like, just reading it, my skin crawled.
I completely agree. I felt like something that was just kind of getting thrown out there where it was just using a bunch of, like, buzzwords.
Right.
And I just thought it was really amusing, especially because, like, this book came out in 2023, I think. And that was just right after the whole, like, NFT craze and, the digital coins really took off. So I thought it was pretty amusing. What I would have liked in this chapter too is, have you seen the TV show Loki?
I've seen the first season.
It reminded me a lot of Loki with the time division.
Oh yeah, I thought about that too. The Time Institute here, the time division there.
Exactly. And I think that also makes a lot of sense considering that that coincides with the release of Loki, just due to like the Time Institute and the role that it plays. But we can discuss that later on.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Okay.
What were your thoughts?
They will be revealed to you throughout this
Sounds
podcast.
Good.
So basically we start out where? Colony 2.
That's right. On the moon.
And do we start out with the mom being in poor health and then it flashes back, or do we start with his childhood and walking by what's her name? Olive's house?
No, not Olive. Olive was the author.
Yeah, because he would walk by Olive's house on the
that's
way
right.
to school.
Yes,
okay. He walks by Olive's house on the way to school. We're told this girl, Tina, no, not Tina, what's her name, Talia, yeah, Talia lives there, and he's, like, interested in Talia. We will get back to Talia, but he knows that Olive lived there, and that's who he was named after, and this is a interesting point that I want to get back to about Gaspary and his conversation later with Olive. But first, Sam and I both are younger brothers of sisters.
That's correct.
So what did you think about the relationship between Gaspary and, man, I'm Zoe?
You know, in a lot of ways, I felt like I could relate to it. I felt like the expectations for me were a lot lower, which is kind of what we see in the book.
Your expectations were lower than those of Gaspary?
No, expectations for me were lower. like in the shadow of my sister.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And the exactly... mom. Both of them, yes. Pretty well regarded physicists, it seems, and
absolutely.
Poor old Gaspari, kind of dim-witted.
In the beginning of this section of the book, we also get the name of the book too, Sea of Tranquility, for where the colony was located.
Oh right. Yeah.
On the moon, which was kind of cool.
So I agree with the sister comment. Like, my sister is pretty successful. If she's listening to this, I don't want to knock her in any way. And there was a decent amount of pressure to live up. But I guess I'm just not Gaspari, but I found it very realistic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's just kind of dealing with that struggle, especially if an older sibling, to no fault of their own, just has a naturally higher inclination for things that are viewed as more success.
And I thought it was interesting, or at least well portrayed, how Gaspari can kind of read into what she's thinking, not only in her own life, but what she's thinking about him.
Absolutely. Which, I mean, that also kind of feeds into, like, the whole role that he ends up playing later on as, like, a detective for the hotel and then ultimately the Time Institute later on.
Yeah, we learned that Gaspari has...
he didn't finish, but he was getting a degree in... criminology.
Criminology. So he does have some unrefined that become refined detective skills, and he does not have a short attention span.
That's right. That seemed like a huge point of, like, focus, which I don't know, just yeah.
So he does a good job with that. He's divorced, which we know, and just lives with his cat, which we get interesting details about.
That's true,
but we'll talk about that later. So his mother is basically on her deathbed.
Yes.
And she dies, and we learn that she worked on, what is it, hologram theory? What is it?
Simulation theory.
And
that she worked for the Time Institute and was some big physicist, apparently.
And people think that's silly, or thought it was silly, until recently, within the Time Institute, they talk about how the timeline seems to correct itself.
Yes.
Now, there's a little bit of a discrepancy here in the way that they describe it, as I read it, at least. Mm-hmm. So, the Time Institute, according to Talia, only corrects mistakes in the past that come back to affect the Time Institute. Mm-hmm. The story we get from the Time Institute is that things, quote-unquote, affect the past simply by being there,
mm-hmm.
but it bends towards the same timeline. Do you think they're talking about the same thing here or different things? Like, do you think the Time Institute's lying, saying, oh, it just seems to bend back? Or do you think Talia is just kind of jaded from her experience with it?
Well, I mean, it's funny that you say that, because he directly says that she has, like, a charming, like, how jaded she is quite charming to him. I think she is jaded due to how it impacted her family, because we end up learning that she was the child of two individuals who worked for the Time Institute. They were living in Colony 1, which was considered super nice. And then after they were let go of their positions, they went to Colony 2.
Yeah, they found out how the other half lives.
Right? And, they kind of just fell from grace because they got discarded. So she has the opinion that since her parents were discarded, people just in general get discarded once they stop being useful to the Time Institute, which is an interesting interaction that we get about halfway through the book, halfway through the chapter.
I guess I should backtrack a little, because, yeah, like you said, whenever her parents got, quote-unquote, discarded, and they moved to Colony 2, she was there for that year that Gaspari kind of develops this infatuation with her.
Yeah.
And he has this very romantic view of Colony 2, which his mother had them live in, because she says, oh, well, at least this place has character.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Talia does not feel that way at all.
Right. I think part of the charm that he just naturally sees for the area is just the fact that that's where he's from. Because I feel like, typically, people are one of two ways, or in general, one of two ways about the place that they grew up. They either, like, have a special place in their heart for it, and it's just kind of, like, special to them, and everybody else would just find it quite bland. Or you could absolutely hate where you come from and then you want to get as far away from it. And I think he very much so falls into the camp of really embracing his origins and that more romantic feel for that aspect of life, I guess.
And I think he does, as we see, want more out of life than what can be provided to him in Colony 2.
Absolutely. But he seems very much so directionless and he just doesn't know how to get there. I think maybe since he was living in the shadow of his sister, to some degree, he maybe didn't possess the confidence in order to chase after what he really wanted to do. And I think this is also shown, I think this was in the second part of the chapter, where he's getting the job at the hotel, and she was basically, some time passes, he is applying.
She being Talia?
Yeah, Talia. They reconnect later on in life in their 30s, where she's the manager at some hotel, I believe.
Yeah, she's the one interviewing.
Yeah, she's the one interviewing him, and I think it's apparent that they don't immediately recognize each other. But basically, where was I going with this? Oh, shoot.
We were talking about having feelings about your hometown.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
Wanting more out of life.
Oh, he didn't possess the confidence. Because in the interview, it seems very evident that he is not a very confident individual with his skills or, like, characteristics that he has. So I think this just feeds into his overall character of, like, he has potential, but he doesn't know how to act upon it. And he's just directionless.
And this kind of reminds me of our old friend Edwin, who was also a second child, also a bit directionless. And we know what happens to Edwin.
We do find out what happens to Edwin.
And something tells me we're gonna have a similar fate for Gaspari. I don't think things are gonna end well for Gaspari.
I think with the themes that were discussed in this chapter, and before simulation theory ever came up, I think it's interesting that you use the phrase fate, because something that really stuck in my mind as I was reading this is fate. Like, the idea that these things are just fated to happen, and there's no, like, free will in a sense, where it's like, this is just destined to occur. And I feel like that's very evident with how the author's laying out the story and calling back to different portions of, like, in, I think it was in chapter 2, Gatsbury was in 2020, and there was the woman who recalled seeing him back in the 1980s getting arrested for supposedly killing two guys.
Under the overpass in Ojai.
Exactly. So it very much so seems like this book deals with a lot of themes of fate and things just destined to be.
And yeah, the concept of, is it real? How much of this do I actually play a role in?
Yeah.
So I thought about this, I don't know if I mentioned it last episode, but in the chapter with Olive, where she's in all these different hotel rooms, and mm-hmm. I do know we talked about, okay, what is the mundane, groundhog-esque nature of the hotel rooms that she's describing? What does this mean? And I think it's supposed to provide this sense of, like, dissonance. The same thing that Gaspari is feeling, and the same thing that our girl Emily St. John Mandel probably felt during quarantine.
Yeah, a lot of people probably felt and could relate to.
And so I think all of this kind of ties together, and it's interesting the way that Gaspari reflects different characters that were previously brought up.
I think that's a really good point, because, like, during COVID, everything kind of stopped. Everybody kind of experienced this. And we're just so used to being go, 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 that in order to, like, take a step back and break it, very much so feels like you're drowning by the lack of movement in your life.
Right. And I think that's a very good point.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So, okay, let's talk some Zoe.
Yes.
So, after Gaspari gets the job at the hotel, he what, does he get a call from Zoe, or does he call Zoe and show up at her office?
Yeah, so after he gets the job at the hotel, he realizes that it's his sister's birthday. He also realizes that his sister had just gotten tenure,
That's what it was. Month ago. Yeah, congrats to her.
And then he forgot to tell her congratulations for tenure after a month had already passed. And he decides to call her on her birthday, and he congratulates her and wishes her a happy birthday. And it was interesting, her response, because she definitely seemed quite, like, drained at the time. But also, she seemed very expectant of his lack of, you know, involvement in her life, of wishing her, like, oh, good job on getting tenure.
Right.
She just comes to be, it seems like she's expecting to be disappointed by her brother, in a sense. Which he picks up himself.
Yeah.
Which I feel like that would be quite agonizing if you know the cause of the disappointment and know that it's just who you are too, which I think that would be quite devastating. But yeah, he goes to visit his sister at the he calls his sister, and then she invites him to come see her at the Time Institute,
and this is where she introduces the idea of the anomalies. She's aware of them. She shows Edwin, she shows
the author, Olive.
Olive, and she shows Paul.
That's right.
Notably, this is one of my biggest speculative points of this section. So he doesn't actually find out how they die or whatever until a couple weeks later, I believe. But we can talk about it because we've already read it. So Edwin dies in an asylum after World War II.
World War One.
And Olive dies 3 days later in New York.
Yes, on the book tour, from the virus that they were talking about. That was popping up in Australia at the time, which just seemed to be like a remote thing. And her husband was like, hey, I'm concerned about this. Yeah.
And did you notice the extreme absence of any mention of Morella or Vincent?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think whenever you get into that speculation, it makes a lot of sense whenever you look at what chapter 6 is, which is Morella and Vincent, where we revisit them, but then it says file corruption next to them. So I think that's going to be very interesting, because it was just those two examples. There was no mention of Morella.
Exactly. And it does seem that Gasparri was being honest in his meeting, how to phrase this, in his first meeting with Morella, Morella's second meeting with him.
Yes.
And I think that in his conversation later with Olive, he will learn something that will take him back to the key being Morella and Vincent.
Oh.
And that's why they're not mentioned, I believe. This is my speculation.
Absolutely.
And on top of that,
I mean, you could almost take that a step further. I mean, a woman disappeared on a cruise line with no trace. I mean, she could have either fallen off the boat or could have been related to some anomaly. Who knows?
Or Gasparri kidnapped her.
That's true. That's a possibility,
I guess. And, yeah, there's... So why...
There's a lot of ways this could go.
Yeah, and it's brought up multiple times. Don't mess with the timeline.
Yes.
So he's going to mess with the timeline.
Oh, I think that's naturally going to occur. And I think it also, with that like fate idea, it even comes up that people don't even have to set out to want to mess with the timeline. It can just happen by accident. But if it happens by accident, no fault of your own, you're still the one who gets kind of like screwed in the process.
And if you really think about it too much, you end up in a classic time travel loop of, okay, they say the time... line bends to correct itself every time. So then you have to wonder if all of this is predetermined, then how much of this is the timeline itself forcing the time traveler to interact in the past, pulling them into the timeline, which becomes the one that never really changes.
Absolutely.
And I don't have the answer for that, because There's always a paradox in time travel, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, let's see. Oh, yeah. Yeah, speaking of messing with the timeline, we do learn that his cat is a time traveler.
From 1984.
George Orwell. That was 1984. Yes. Oh, wasn't it? And Taylor Swift, I guess. But
you were quick to come up with that one.
Yeah, well, I knew they were the same year, but then I started freaking out, thinking, oh, God, is it 1984? It is. It is. We're cool.
Fair enough.
But speaking of messing with the timeline, we learn that Zoe had a past lover who, in the 80s, not to mention the 80s, were when Morella was saw. In Ojai mm-hmm. under the overpass.
That's right.
So,
and that's also where she saw Gatsby.
Yeah. And so it really makes you wonder if he's going to go get some vengeance for his sister. And on top of that, we already talked about him messing with the timeline. Where's it going with that?
It's a tough day.
Tough day. Long week. But
no, absolutely. Because what we learn is Zoe had a past lover.
Thank you.
Zoe had a past lover who went rogue, where apparently they have these chips at the Time Institute because they employ people who are detectives, I guess, or time detectives, mm-hmm. where they go back in time to observe these anomalies that we've been seeing throughout the book. And one of these detectives, presumably one of, or Zoe's ex-lover, who she has like a bracelet or a necklace of, or from, decided to take out her chip and then give the chip to the cat. And then whenever they tried to bring the time traveler back, the cat came back. And so that's how he ended up getting the cat.
And she gave it to Gaspard.
Yeah, exactly. And he seemed quite upset that his cat was a time traveler. Nobody told him. Absolutely. Which is nice to see that they don't change after 400 years of more domestication.
So,
but okay. after this meeting, we see that he gets quite enamored with this whole idea of like time travel and also, like these anomalies popping up.
Right. Yes. Because he just can't get it out of his head. This whole what's real, what isn't real thing. And I think that
struggling with the idea if he has free will or not.
Yeah. I think it's great symbolism that he feels uncomfortable in the world that is not real, aka Colony One, the one with the dome that works.
Yeah.
And yearns for Colony Two, where there is no artificial facade dome thing over the colony.
Absolutely.
Allowing him to see things clearly.
And I think we see a big character shift in him at this point, because then he becomes says to his sister on several occasions that this is the only thing that he's ever really cared about, because he decides he wants to try to get involved in this, and his sister tries to dissuade him from this, and he just says, don't you see this is the only thing that like I've only ever really cared about? And she's like, I don't care. And he's like, but this is all I care about.
So what do you think about Ephraim? Because Ephraim's like, yeah, come on, buddy. Join the Time Institute. And Zoe's like, what? Why? No.
Right. So
does Ephraim have pure intentions?
No, I do not think Ephraim has pure intentions. I think Ephraim is a guy who he's like playing chess with pawns. He needs people. He works at the Time Institute. Presumably, he's a director of some kind. He employs people to be these time agents.
And his recruitment numbers are down.
Recruitment numbers are down. He has a bad rap. People are trying to dissuade him. His sister, who works for him, is like, no, you don't want to work here. Talia says, no, you don't want to work there. They toss my parents to the side. So I think Ephraim is very much so appearing to be a nice guy, trying to give him like an opportunity to pursue his passions.
Because they were childhood friends, right?
Right, exactly. I think they went to school together. But I think Ephraim is very much so seeing this as, oh, I have one on the line, another person that I could like, use for my means. Because it's also mentioned...
The chai tea? Are you going to the chai tea?
Go for it.
Is that what you were going to say?
I was going to talk about how it's mentioned how the Time Institute is like its own organism. And so whenever Talia is talking to him, she mentions how the Time Institute only tries to serve its own purpose of protecting itself. And if Ephraim's like the head of that, that kind of makes sense.
That does make a lot of sense. But and yeah, no, honestly, the biggest red flag from Ephraim to me was how Gaspari recalls that when he and Ephraim were friends, they would go to Ephraim's mom's house, who would make chai tea.
Mm-hmm.
And then, whenever, after he has his conversation with Talia, who's telling him don't do it,
yeah.
And he calls up Ephraim and he says, hey, can I get started right now? And he's like, yeah, come to my office.
Yeah, in an hour.
In an hour. And Ephraim's sitting there waiting with the chai tea. So he's really suckering him. And I was like, oh, this manipulative bastard, dude.
So like, you're not a fan of Ephraim?
I don't know.
I think he's very Machiavellian. Like he's
in a sense. I want to like him because he's a tree guy.
Yeah, no, true. Absolutely. I love trees, man.
I you know, I like trees. Trees are awesome. Anyone that's a friend of trees is a friend of me.
Fun fact, I have an avocado tree that I've been growing since I was like 12 or 13 years old. It's still alive, still growing. In a few years, it should start to produce avocados.
You think? Why did... Wait, did you buy the seed from...
No, I just used like an avocado from like the grocery store. Like my mom made guacamole and I just took one of the seeds and then started growing
it. I was under the impression that if you use a seed from a... from an avocado, it would always be... I don't know, the non-fruit-bearing kind.
I have also heard this, but I learned this after I'd already been growing the tree for, like, 7 years. And so I've never taken the time to look into it out of the sheer disappointment
right.
of growing this tree for nearly half of my life now. So you're probably right, yeah.
All
right,
so just so you guys know, we're friends of trees. That's here right. We love Chapters the Trees. At a Time. So, yeah, but we're not friends of Ephraim.
No, Ephraim's definitely, I think he's not the most pure intentioned.
And we speedrun 5 years of training for Gaspari.
That's right, because we learned that in order to become one of these time detectives, you don't just get to do the job. You have to learn the backstories of the people that you're going to go see. You have to learn about the environment of these anomalies happening. And so you have to learn, you essentially get whole dossiers on these individuals. And this apparently is also something that weighs quite heavily on the people, because you're going to learn about people and then you're going to learn exactly how they're going to die. And you might learn about how they die in the most preventable of ways, but you just have to let it happen. Which Zoe and our guy don't necessarily like.
Yeah. They say that,
understandably,
basically humanity is your worst enemy in this role.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I can see how anyone that works there would find that undesirable in a workplace condition.
Absolutely.
We get our very first time travel of Gaspari, and he meets up with Alan Sammy. And Sammy wrote the violin piece that we hear during all of the things. And the whoosh, we learn, is, in fact, an airship. The thing that I find interesting about that is before it seemed the anomaly, whatever you want to call it, only occurred in British Columbia. But this guy is in Oklahoma City.
That's right. So he's around during the book tour of Olive. He's in a giant, what's it called? Just like a giant airship station. He plays the violin. He doesn't play for money. He makes that apparent. But he just really enjoys playing the violin.
Yeah, it's like people kept throwing money at me, so I thought I'd put my hat on the ground.
That was kind of funny. Yeah. And then he's like, just to be clear, I don't need the money. But basically, he composed this piece for his late wife who passed. And he just goes out in public to play the violin because he loves playing the violin. And he wrote this piece that he never wrote down, but it was in like remembrance to his wife. But this is apparently the composition that keeps popping up throughout history, which is kind of interesting because I think a very big part of this book are like themes of love and themes of like relationships. And I think that might end up playing a big role throughout the book and how maybe love or relationships ends up like transcending time. But that could be a bit speculative.
You know, Sam, that's a very good insight. Because if you think about every single character that we've been introduced to, the only one I can think of that isn't in some form of significant relationship is Edwin. Because after that, we get Mirella and Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
From Mirella and Vincent, we get Olive, mm-hmm. who, I mean, a lot can be said about that relationship, and a lot was said in our last episode. So, then we get Zoe. We get, you know, in her time travel relationship, and then we get Gaspari and Talia.
Oh, absolutely. But more than just... what I mean by love, I don't just mean in the, like, strictly romantic sense, but, like, in the terms of, like, a father for his son and, like, a father exiling his son.
Right.
And then in chapter two, we're dealing with a woman who's lost her husband that she clearly is still deeply in love with and trying to distract herself from. And then in chapter three, we're dealing with a woman who's separated from her child and from her husband, and she wants to be by them, but due to the necessities of life, she has to be away from them and ultimately ends up dying away from them. And then here in chapter four, we're dealing with the relationship of, like, a brother and sister, and also maybe some, like, romantic inclinations of what could be if he decided to pursue, like, Talia. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I this is just something that I just thought of at this moment, but I think that could be... It seems very thematic, in my opinion.
I look forward to our retrospective on this book.
Absolutely.
Even though we've, I mean, we're a little over halfway. Next week, should we cover two chapters? Because then we could do, how many chapters are there?
I think there's eight overall. Let me look.
If there's eight overall and we just finished four.
Yeah, if we do two next time, then we'll have two left.
I was kind of hoping that we could, I was hoping it would be seven. But isn't the last one like super short, or one of them's like 10 pages or something?
Yeah, the next chapter is actually the longest one.
Oh, never mind. We will do
Wait, one. No, never mind. This was the longest
one. This was the longest one. Okay, so, yeah, we'll do two chapters next week. Okay. So, program scheduling aside, I think I owe Emily St. John Mandel an apology for what I said last week about her not connecting characters and that she would not be forgiven. I count this. This counts. All the characters are drawn together. You're good, Emily.
Absolutely.
But as far as relationships go, what? I don't... And there was that thing last chapter where she says, I was just trying to tell a good story.
Mm. Yeah.
And obviously, that's not the case. Like, there's a deeper meaning here. And at this point in time... I don't know what it is. Are we doing like a Interstellar thing where we sit here and debate what's real and what isn't real, and the only thing that's real is love. Relationships with yeah. others, and she felt isolated during COVID, thus was reflecting on the importance of relationships relative to everything else?
I think that's a great speculation, especially whenever you're dealing with whatever you consider like that time period and people were isolated from their family members, couldn't really associate with them or with their friends or coworkers, and everybody was just kind of like socially isolated for a pretty long time. That's not very typical.
Right. That's kind of also counter to humanity.
Absolutely, where we just strive for connections and like being able to relate to one another, whether it be through like books and relate to the characters or just like in friends and hanging out. Absolutely. But with that tangent aside of like themes of love and relationships, we jump 5 years into the future and now he's a time agent and he went to go basically interview this violin player.
Yeah, we don't really get anything great out of that, but we do know that he is going to interview Olive next.
That's right.
And then she's gonna die. So
mm-hmm.
we're kind of left on a cliffhanger. I look forward to this next chapter. And honestly, I think that might be all the points that I had coming in today. So
absolutely. And I mean, it makes a lot of sense because the next chapter is connecting back with Olives, because it's like we went up the time, up the time period, and now we're going to come back down and see how things essentially end up. But yeah, no, it was interesting to see the concepts of like simulation theory and how it seems to be presented here. Do you have any other comments about like some of the themes or the tropes that are used within this book chapter?
I'm trying to think if we neglected anyone. Oh, I said this kind of at the, or maybe I've already said this in the episode. Did I already say that he lies to Olive when he says that his mother was the only one who, or his mother thought that she came up with the name Gaspari?
Oh.
And he knows of Olive's existence from, like, the day he's born, because he knows he's named after the character in Marinbad.
And walks by her house every single day.
Yeah.
Which, I think that kind of just gets into, like, the whole, like, grandfather paradox, where he was named after the character in a book, but, like, yeah, yeah.
This also, yeah, ties in with the whole thing of fate. Like, what are the odds that this guy's born right next to the house that of the author that basically created his name, that he also gets to go interview in the past? Absolutely. A lot of themes of fate.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what develops, especially since we don't know what happens with Marilla and Vincent. We don't know what the end of their story is. We don't know what's causing these anomalies. But these anomalies seem to be indications that the simulation exists, and that's why they're wanting to investigate them. So it's going to be interesting, because now I think it's going to be a more like, I think in the first half of the book, we were developing the characters from before they got interviewed, and now we're going to be full on Gaspari just riding the wave down.
Oh yeah, I think these next 100 or so pages are going to be very good.
I think this is the longest it has taken for a main character to really be introduced meaningfully in a book that I've read. Because if he is truly the main character, like, we see him as, like, Father Roberts, we get a little bit more of a taste in chapter 2. Chapter 3, he appears again. So it just seems like only in chapter 4 is he really, like, fully revealed to us who the main character is, which I think is a little bit interesting.
Yeah, I at first had concerns about the structure of this book, but right now,
yeah,
I think it was a good choice. It's really interesting.
That's true, that's true. I mean, please forgive us for our previous comments in previous episodes. We didn't know where this was going.
No, I'm not a hater anymore, so we'll see if that changes next week. Thank you for tuning in to Chapters at a Time. And like we said earlier in the episode, next week we will be covering the next two chapters, which are...
we're going to be covering...
The Last Book Tour on Earth, Part 2, and Marilla and Vincent File Corruption. So...
That's right.
Until next time.
Which I want to point out is kind of interesting, because every chapter of the book, it gives you the title and then the year. Except for that one, Marilla and Vincent.
Yeah, dude, corruption. I think...
So do they end up time traveling? I don't know.
Next week, I might knock this book for being too predictable. We'll see.
It's fate, Mason.
It's fate.